Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And this is episode number 110. 110. And we're going to talk about Mockingbird by Walter Tevis. And how did you find out about this amazing book that I'd never heard of that was written in 1980?
My mother minds the daily Kindle deals. She can't get out to the library, and she's a voracious reader. And I think maybe they just released a whole bunch of his stuff on the Kindle. And so they were all on the daily deal, and she tried it and then read it like in a day and then called me up and started pestering me so that I would read it too, which is one of the things I love about her. That's how the Rosie Project got read too.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
I love that.
Did that
that's
to me
neat.
With the Rosie Project. The last thing she said before we got off the phone was, and don't just put it on that list. Get it and read it. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Don't just write it down in that notebook.
Yes. With the 20
I love
pages
it.
And things. So she was so excited by this that I downloaded the sample and I could not quit reading the sample. And so luckily the library had it. So I blasted through this thing in probably 2 days.
Yeah, me too.
And I was so overcome by it that after I read it the first time, I couldn't read anything else for 2 or 3 days, any fiction, because I just wanted to think about the book, and it was so beautifully written that nothing could compare. So that's why I thought I'd like to read it again, and you might like it too.
That's right. Yeah, I got it, and then I read probably the first 10 pages and was just completely blown away by it. I mean, I was just, you know, mouth dropped open. And then I didn't get back to it until this previous weekend. And I started it at the beginning again, and I read the whole thing really quickly. But I was riveted. It was just absolutely fantastic and just full of wisdom. But yeah, the opening chapter, I was just like, oh my goodness. I felt so bad for this robot.
I know.
Well, but it was so poetic what was going on.
Well, and from the very beginning, little lines will be dropped where you suddenly do a double take and you realize this author is doing a lot more deep thinking way up front than you expected. For example, they're talking about this robot, and we'll do the summary in a minute, but they were saying that they changed some things about the body. This is a human, basically a cloned human, and they put the brain in. But they said that, you know, it could continue to grow new teeth or new fingers, never go bald, never develop faulty vision. It was, as the genetic engineers were fond of saying, an improvement upon the work of God. Since none of the engineers believed there was a God, however, their self-praise was unsound. And I read that line and went, whoa, I have to reread this paragraph now.
Yeah. Yep. Good stuff. Good stuff. So, yeah, go ahead. Do you want to summarize?
I will attempt it. Basically,
all right.
This is, I was going to check the date. I think it's something like 2535 in the future, obviously. And it's not a great future for humans, but not in the way that we often think. Basically, there are plenty of robots to do all the work, and human beings are given nominal jobs, and they're also given, as much as they want, of various drugs called SOPRs, and I assume that's for soporific, which is, you know, kind of calms you down and everything. And they have been taught from childhood, which they did not experience with families, but just in, you know, group raising settings, like dormitory type settings, these rules of privacy and self-fulfillment and pleasure. Things like, don't ask, relax. When in doubt, forget it. And quick sex is best. They are not allowed to touch each other or look each other in the eye. And so they've learned all this from the time they were tiny. So it's just automatic. And what this has done is you've got a whole society of people who are all alone. But of course, they don't realize it because they're drugged out of their minds. And running everything are these various robots who, you know, have various levels of intelligence, from things like street sweepers to burger makers to the Make Nine, that's what it's called.
Make Nine,
named Spofforth. Mm-hmm. And he is super intelligent. He's the last kind of robot that was made based on a human brain. And he runs the entire city of New York, although he's really the dean of the university. And when the book opens, he's going to the top of the Empire State Building. And he's been created so that he can't kill himself.
Yeah, it's like, not unlike Asimov's robots.
Mm-hmm.
Although this was written in 1980, but it doesn't, mention Asimov at all. Although you could kind of feel Asimov in here in mm-hmm. various aspects.
I didn't feel that way because he, as it turns out, can do things that are in his own self-interest above human beings.
Absolutely right. Yeah, and then the question is, motivation and things. This is
right.
This is almost a counterpoint to, I don't know how far in Asimov stuff that you've read, and it would be really a huge spoiler to talk about what the robots did for humanity or did not do in Asimov's
later
books.
That far into them. Okay. I mean, like the Foundation and Foundation's Edge or whatever.
And the robot,
it is.
And then the Foundation books and the robot books become kind of one series at the end of Asimov's life.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
But robots had quite a lot to do with the history of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
In there, as they do in this book.
Right. And in this book, it's told from three points of view. So one is Spofforth, who we meet mm-hmm. first. The next one is Paul. And Paul writes Spofforth a letter. He's in Ohio, and he's a teacher. But he's taught himself how to read. And this is when you find out no one knows how to read anymore. They've all lost it. And he found some children's books and eventually, looking through them, figured out, oh, wait, this teacher is showing what these letters are. And so he figured it out. And Spofforth can't read also. And Spofforth says, oh, yeah, come on. And he wants him to watch silent films because there's no sound. You can't tell what's going on. He needs someone to speak into a recorder what the words are saying that show up every so often.
Yeah.
And then the third person is, why can I not remember her name? I should.
Mary Lou.
How could I not remember that? Mary Lou is somebody who dropped out of the system and somehow just managed to stay undercover until Paul discovers her living at the zoo. Mm-hmm. She's very intelligent. She's very interested in the idea of reading. And Paul is very interested in her. And so Mary Lou is the third person who we meet. And together, what you see is, I don't know how much more to tell about it, really. It's because it's this dying, stagnant world. Very early on, Paul realizes there aren't any children. And he's like, I think I was the last of the children, and I'm in my 30s. Why aren't there any more?
Yeah, he notices that.
Yeah, and what happens is Spofforth's memories were scrubbed as much as they could be of anything human so that he could just concentrate on his work. But because cutting out certain things, certain kinds of memories would mess up his brain, he's been left with things like if he ever saw a piano, he'd be able to play it. There are certain tunes that he hums. He has a memory of somebody who fell in love with, the original brain, the person fell in love with. And so as these three people interact over the idea of reading, which is forbidden, and watching these movies, and Paul and Mary Lou being the only two people who aren't taking all these drugs and are actually alert and paying attention, it weaves this story of a real love of the written word, of nature, and of humanity.
You know, he's watching all these old films at the same time, and it's extremely powerful.
And it's only 250 pages. This guy, it's beautifully written. He did an amazing job of packing this layered story in there. And when I read it the second time, I was wondering if I would like it as much, because I thought, well, maybe it was just the surprise of finding it. Oh, my goodness, no. There is so much in there.
It's, this is a pool room book.
Oh, yes. This is maybe number two after Lord of the Rings. I'm not positive, but...
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
It really is something that, you know, I would love to own a nice copy of this one, too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Make Nine robot, Spofforth, he was one of many that were made.
Right.
But every single other one of them successfully committed suicide.
Yeah.
Except for himself.
He
was designed not to. So he was the only one of that type of robot that exists anymore. Because he can't kill himself, but it's interesting that, you know, that's a commentary on the world that he was in, because his memory of being human doesn't match what's going on in the world. And I know there's more to it coming up, but none of those robots who remembered what it was like to be human could live in this society.
Right. And it's not that they specifically remember, here's how my human life was. It's just that these memories will pop up, or they'll have dreams that are very vivid. And so they're constantly haunted by this sense of melancholy over something that they can't fulfill. And they were created without any way to physically express love, basically.
Yeah.
But they can, because they have these human personalities and memories, they can fall in love. So you've got someone who's got all these yearnings, can fall in love, and can't kill himself. And you can also see the other human part is that he likes to fix things. Not like a hobby, but it annoys him when he'll see something that's wrong, but the robots or people are too stupid because no one knows to fix something. You just have to do, like, pull this little thing out that was clogging something.
Right, right.
And so he'll kind of amuse himself by going around and fixing things sometimes in the city.
And it's been... hundreds of years, right? He's been alive for, I can't remember how long, but it has been hundreds of years. So he, you know, if he does fall in love, he gets to see them pass away. You know, but the people are also seem to be very long lived. Did you get that impression, or is that a false impression?
I didn't feel that way.
Okay.
But I don't think I thought about it much. It wasn't pointed out, so you could be right.
So, yeah, so regardless, but the society itself has just moved on, but with people being, you know, just slowly drugged and everything until they reach the society that it was in the novel, where they're normally not alert at all, and nobody in that world is making robots.
No.
Right?
No.
So
humans are...
You've got, you know, Spofforth, and then all of the models that are below him, which get, you know, increasingly dumb as you go lower in number. And, you know, some of them they call moron robots that, you know, just do a specific task without any real knowledge or emotions at all. And, but he's like the king of the heap. He is fully alert. He's a robot, and he's running pretty much everything. But, you know, nothing's being created. Nothing's moving forward.
Well, and one of the other interesting things is the human beings, there are, of course, plentiful drugs, and there's plenty of food, I guess. And so they need nothing. They want for nothing. Their clothes, they are given these nominal jobs that are really nothing. So they're not challenged at all. And, but there's still something deep inside of some people that can't take it, because a new trend is these group immolations, where three people will gather together and then burn themselves to death in a public place. So this is a growing discord within the society, even though supposedly they have everything they want. I mean, you know, there are videos galore And as much sex as you want, as long as it's quick and you don't get attached, I guess. It's all the things that you think you would want if you're just going for physical comfort and pleasure.
Yeah, so what of those things do you think... Well, I guess the question is, do you think that the author was commenting on trends that he was seeing? And do they remain valid today? It was written in 1980, and it is 2015. So this is, what, 35 years old?
Yeah. I actually think that we've kind of taken a little bit of a different turn because he couldn't foresee the internet and the constant distraction of Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and all these little things that we let just pull us in a thousand directions. But I think the book still applies because, for one thing, none of those things are deeply satisfying either. They're just as bad as watching the TV all the time in the sense of being human. And so if that's all you've got, you're kind of left with the conditions of the book. And one of the things that he talks about in this book, well, or that the characters discover, is that you can't really think very well or know yourself or learn anything new very well if you don't have stories. And for stories, you have to be connected in a way that either through books to people of the past or through telling them to each other or whatever it is that you don't get from this flat entertainment. Do you think? I don't know. That's
I mean, it does hit me in a similar way. You know, one of the striking things for me is the aloneness and how being alone is so important, you know, to everyone. You know, they just believe that this is the way that you do it. And they're, you know, getting close to a person or looking them in the eye is considered rude. You know, it's not something that you would ever do. It's not the custom.
Yeah, it's a mistake of proximity. It's a violation of proximity.
That's what it is. Yeah, so there
it's
are
immoral.
Rules. Capital R, right?
Yeah.
There are rules, and you don't do it. And but without that interaction, you know, everybody needs to be numbed, I suppose. You know, it's you know, no one's telling stories to each other. And
you're right. It's that sense of aloneness. Because even though there's a crowd of people, they're all very alone. And they, it's funny when Mary Lou is talking about the old silent movie, she's like, everybody's talking all the time. They're all talking to each other or on the phone or, you know, whatever. And she said, why don't we talk to each other? Because people don't even talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And
early on.
Go ahead.
I was going to say.
Go ahead. You go.
Early on, Bentley, when he started watching the silent film, said, you know, there's this concept of a family. And look at them. And they, you know, he talked about that too. They're always talking to each other. But yeah, so I was just kind of reiterating your point.
No, well, because, and I think I might have marked that where he says this, it's Paul Bentley is his name. So, but he says at some point that he's looking at it and going, oh, this is just awful. I think they're all related to each other. Ugh.
Yeah.
That's terrible. That's pretty immoral. But as the story goes on and he meets Mary Lou and falls in love with her, he very early on starts thinking, I would like to be a father. And he's thinking it in the most naive, childlike way possible because he doesn't know what it means. And he's very immature himself because, you know, he's had no experience to build on. But he's like, I want to give her flowers and I want to dance with her and I would like to be a father and have a family. I want to do all these things I saw in these silent movies.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, he sees an old man dying in the movie and everybody's throwing themselves on the bed and crying in this paroxysm of grief. And he's like, oh, that's awful. See, that's just looks like the saddest thing ever. That's terrible. And by the end of the book, he thinks about that scene and he thinks that's a wonderful thing. They cared. Your life mattered to them.
Yeah. And it's being presented in this movie as good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was it.
Right.
He's like, why are they acting like it's good?
Right. And then he starts to think about, well, what is good? You know, and that starts to permeate through the rest of his thinking for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this morality that he was given and the morality that is true. He's learning the difference, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then kind of something that ties into that story aspect that you're talking about is as he starts to get to know Mary Lou at the zoo, you know, he says, well, what do you do here all day? And she said that lately I've been trying to memorize my life.
Yes.
And that in a way, that's telling herself stories, like you're saying. Memorize my life. The phrase was so odd that I said nothing. And then she just says, you should try it sometime. First you remember a thing that happened, and then you go over and over it. That's memorizing. If I keep it up long enough, I'll have it all, and I'll know it like a story or a song.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, she can't be sane.
Yeah, something's wrong with her.
Right. It's not taking the drugs. What could have happened to her mind? You know?
Well, because he stops before he even meets her, he stops taking the drugs every so often because it's interfering with his ability to record stuff, and mm-hmm. it's just forcing him out of the usual patterns. And it doesn't mean he doesn't go back to it when he's too upset.
Mm-hmm.
But he starts watching those movies makes him look for more, even if it's just going to the zoo and yeah. watching the animals. Yeah. Which you discover are, well, maybe I won't say what they are. But anyway,
yeah.
And in fact, later when he talks about memorizing your life, he's like, that's a good idea. So he starts writing a journal. He's like, this is hard. It's so hard to concentrate on this and remember this stuff and put this stuff together. And you never think about the fact that all this mental work is something they're not used to at all.
Yeah. And his journal at first is him speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point in the journal, he says, I'm writing this down now.
Right.
And, you know, as he gets better and better at reading and writing from translating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's one other thing that I thought was really interesting here around this time in the book. And it is, again, about Mary Lou. And I'll just read a little piece of it. He says, I stared at her. The branch was quite high, and she had to stand tiptoed, and you know right where I'm at.
Yes, I do.
And reach up as far as she could reach just to catch the bottom of the fruit with her fingertips. With the strong light from inside of the case coming through her dress, her body was outlined clearly, and it was beautiful. She plucked the fruit and stood there poised like a dancer with it for a moment. And then she gives him this fruit, and then she says, this certainly can't be eaten. But, you know, which I think was more of a comedy from the author. But it was, you know, the symbolism is just so obvious. You know, here it is, you know, the knowledge of good and evil, right?
Well, he says, I took it from her. Why did mm-hmm. you pick it? I said, I don't know. She said, it seemed to be the thing to do. And so he says, I looked at her for a long time, saying nothing, despite the age lines and the sleep lines in her face, and despite the uncombed look of her hair, she was very beautiful. And yet I felt no desire for her, only a kind of awe and a slight sense of fear. And so he puts the fruit in his pocket, and they both, and he goes back to the library, and he says, he puts the fruit on his desk, and he says, or on top of the dictionary.
Uh-huh.
And he says, the fruit is still sitting there. I want it to mean something, but it doesn't. But we know it does because
it comes up
again.
Yeah, exactly. And I love that these people seem to have a sense of the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, we know that there's something to this. They both do. Yet they don't understand what it is. And I thought that was really terrific.
Yeah, it's as if these symbols are somehow innate.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's a very deep... Once he wakes up, once Paul is off the drugs and actually walking around outside in nature, which happens more later on... But I noticed that he's got this deep appreciation for nature without understanding why he has it. he'll just suddenly stop and say, I was looking at the sky or I was watching the ocean. Or, and Mary Lou loves flowers. And I noticed that the book that she picks when they finally find a room that's not full of chess books in this library, the book she picks is The Wildflowers of North America. And she loves flowers. And I thought, well, that's like Eve, isn't it? It's the garden.
Yeah, yeah.
And throughout the book, because Paul is continually looking at nature, and even when it arouses feelings that he doesn't even understand what they are, it is changing him somehow just through being around it. And there's this one thing about the spider web, if I can find it, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead, yeah.
He was very frustrated over something. And he goes outside. He says, outside, the moon had come out. It was full, a disk of bright silver. I saw a large, dramatic spider web on my back porch that must have been made while I was in the house with my mind in turmoil. The spider was just finishing the outer circle of it. The moon illuminated the strands of the big, taut web so that it seemed to be made of pure light. It was dazzling, geometric, and mysterious, and it calmed me just to stop and look at it, at the elaboration and power of life that could make such a design. And so what that made me think of is one of my absolute favorite psalms, which is Psalm 19, and a lot of people know the beginning of it at least. It says, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." So just that whole understanding of God speaks to us in ways we can't even comprehend through the nature that he created.
Yeah.
And that resonates through this book. I mean,
it does. Yeah. I've got another example right in front of me.
Oh, good.
It's him writing his journal, day 40, 40 days. It is all written out on my desk in front of me on 72 pages of art paper, all of it printed by me. So we know how important 40 days is.
Oh, God,
and 72 is an important number over and over. One of the things it is, it's the traditional number of languages spoken at the Tower of Babel or Tower of Babylon. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, God.
Yeah. So, well, we learned that way back reading Ted Chiang, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
72 letters. Yeah. The Tower of Babylon.
The number of disciples that when Jesus sent all the disciples out and said, now go out and test everything out, don't take anything with you. It was 72 disciples that he sent.
Yeah. See, and that number is just kind
of
all over the place.
It just pops up again and again. Yeah.
Exactly. And so does 40.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It exactly like you said, it's like this is just happening. There's some kind of a connection, you know, that just happens. And he's connected to it. Even though he certainly doesn't realize it at this moment. I think he realizes it later.
Yes. I have some wonderful things to say about that. I don't know if we're there yet, but maybe.
Yeah. And then,
you can't say much more about it without spoiling it, except that watching these three, well, especially Paul and Mary Lou, grow and learn, and the different ways that they understand things from each other, I mean, apart from each other, it's just fascinating.
Yeah, it is. And it starts out, I mean, it's just Spofforth and Bentley, you know, Paul. And then Mary Lou starts to show up, you know, just chapters from her point of view. It was fantastic. If we're gonna end the summary here, then by all means, go read this book.
It is
one of my favorites.
It's such a surprise. It really is. And the author is really clearly making some points, but yet, although they continually pop up here and there, it's not like he's hitting you over the head, because Paul and Mary Lou themselves don't know exactly what to think about the things that they're thinking. So they may draw conclusions about things, but one thing that makes it kind of fresh is that they're totally divorced from any traditional way that we would understand things. So their interpretations are all hard found by themselves, and they're brand new. And so seeing where they overlap with what we think or what we've been taught, and seeing where they kind of take off and go in a different direction or are kind of vague because they're like, well, I'm not sure what to think about that. I'll think about it later. It really opens you up to thinking yourself about all these things again, which is what the best books do, of course.
Yeah.
Plus, it's a great story. Really great story.
Well put. Yeah. And I agree. It is also a great story. I also believe that, too. Terrific. Terrific book.
Oh, God, I'm so glad.
Now it can be spoilerific.
Okay. Where do you want to go first?
Awesome. Boy, there's so many places to go. I mean, we just kind of keep going chronologically, I guess.
We can.
You know, right after that 40 days thing, he says, you know, this journal is the greatest achievement of my life. Yes, I have used that word, a great achievement. My learning to read was an achievement. No one knows that but me. Spofforth doesn't know it, but then Spofforth is a robot, and a robot might just know anything. But robots can achieve nothing. They have been constructed to do what they do and cannot change. You think that's true for Spofforth?
No.
He's the only robot for which that's not true.
Right, because he's got so much humanity ingrained in him.
Yeah.
He would like to drain that humanity out, frankly, because that's what makes him want to kill himself. Mm-hmm. He's tortured because he's stuck in between. He's halfway human, but he's not allowed to be fully human.
Right.
And it's killing him, you know. Literally.
When you said that, it just made me think Angel. It popped in my head.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not sure why. I mean, does that really fit? I'm thinking about it, but
not really, because Angel had free will.
Yeah.
And Spofforth does too, to a certain degree. You know, no one's telling him to run and fix things.
Yeah, he can't exercise his free will to kill himself.
Right.
But he seems to have free will elsewhere.
Yeah, because
in fact we find out later that he's done something incredibly selfish in order to try to bring about his own demise in a circuitous way.
Well, and it's funny because it's selfish, but what I felt like it was complete desperation.
Yes.
Uh-huh. It was, well, I don't think of him as being crazy, but he does tell Mary Lou when she says, oh, you should write down your life, because she starts doing her journal again. And then you won't forget anything. And he says, I've lived hundreds of years and I can't forget a single thing. And she says, that must be awful. And he said, yes, it is, or whatever. And she's filled with pity for him.
And that was a surprising statement from her, who's been spending all this time trying to memorize her life.
Yeah.
But it shows you that what she's doing is not really memorizing her life. She's considering it. She's contemplating.
Right.
Yeah, it's a contemplative thing. It's not, you know, which I think is a huge statement about today's society, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which he, you know, couldn't have possibly have known, you know, the distractions that we have now.
Yeah.
But the importance of contemplation and of reading and of deep reading and things like that are things that are getting lost today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because, and I'm guilty of this too, I have to make myself take my iPod and put it away so that I'm not continually going, I just need to finish Dracula or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my priest one time pointed that out when I was talking about something, and he said, silence is the only way God's really going to get through. So you have to let yourself just let your brain run some.
Yeah, and I think that that's important too. I've been reading a little debate online. There was somebody who started to talk about, you know, distraction and how, you know, somebody said in a blog post that they actually couldn't even sit through an entire song anymore.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that's, you know, I'm not there. I'm certainly not
right
there. And then, you know, he's talking about you know, some people say they don't read books anymore, and I can't, you know, finish a song, a whole song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a lamentation of that, this blog post, and it was like, you know, sort of saying that, you know, we ought to try to regain some of that. And then in a rebuttal, somebody came out and said, well, this is kind of how we're headed. Maybe instead of trying to read books, we should embrace this new paradigm and try to figure out how to tell stories or pass information in this new way and see what comes out of it. So this guy is saying, you know, we're going to move forward, and what you're decrying as a bad thing, maybe it isn't a bad thing. Maybe we're just moving forward, you know, just like Socrates saying, you know, hey, this print stuff is probably not a very good idea, you know. So they're pulling that out. But I know in my own life, there's no way that I can deny that deep things have been the most meaningful things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a deep reading of a book is the most meaningful way to read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously a deep relationship, you know, the more time that you spend with somebody in a deep way is incredibly satisfying.
Right.
So, in religion, you know, is when I became Catholic again and started going into that in depth rather than bouncing around at the top looking at all religions as if, you know, that's some kind of a really wise thing to do. I'm not, you know, it's, you can't experience it deeply being up here on the top just reading about them.
Well, yeah, you can use that as a way to kind of go, well, I'm curious about this, but yeah, you can't stay there at the top.
Right. And once you make the decision to go ahead and delve, you know, it's the delving that gives you the deepness, and the deepness, which is so satisfying. So I'm just saying that I can't see the new way as being good yet, if at all. All I can say is that by stopping and shutting things off sometimes and being able to read this book, for example, is something that's extremely worthwhile and not to be replaced.
Well, exactly, because it's the reading and the rereading and the thinking about it in between and letting things hit you. Now you know what you've read, so you can kind of relax with the top-level story and you can let the other stuff sink in. And I have to say, thinking about what that person was saying, I just recently had an experience that made me more in sympathy with the author than ever, because I started reading Beowulf. And it's, you know, one of a more dynamic translation and blah, blah, blah. And I said, I'm just going to think of it like those classic books for kids. I may read a better translation someday, but this is better than nothing, and I'm going to read it. And it was because when I was looking at the sample and some of the translator's notes, and actually it's because the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast talked about it, and I knew you and Jesse had covered it, and I went, okay, I'm going to dig deeper now. But they were talking about some stuff, and I went, oh my gosh, I relate to that. I love the idea that the sea is called the Whale Road, and I can suddenly see myself standing on a cliff next to these people watching the whales out in the ocean. I had a moment of connection with those people. Yeah. And then I was reading a sample for the Iliad, and I was thinking, and it was another thing, a translator's note. They were talking about the bonfires, the 1,000 bonfires outside of Troy at night, and there's something about what they were doing around the bonfire, and I suddenly went, oh my gosh, I'm suddenly taken back to when we would go to this bluegrass festival and we would camp out and you would see all the other fires and you'd step away from yours and you could hear the people talking. You could hear the main stage where people were singing and you could see the stars. And I went, I know how those soldiers felt. And it was another connection with those long ago people. And it makes me think of, at one point, Paul is being sentenced for the crime of reading, and the computer, or the judge, which is a robot, has to look up what reading is, and the archive says, Reading is the subtle and thorough sharing of ideas and feelings by underhanded means. It is a gross invasion of privacy and a direct violation of the constitutions of the Third, Fourth, and Fifth Ages. The teaching of reading is equally a crime against privacy, capital P, and personhood, capital P. And then I think about what Paul said toward the end of the book. He's going to New York. And he says, I feel strong and free and strong. If I were not a reader of books, I could not feel this way. Whatever may happen to me, thank God that I can read, that I have truly touched the minds of other men.
Hmm. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. And when I read him saying that, and I thought of the fact that I was starting to read Beowulf, and it's almost the perfect book for me because it's kind of weird fiction-y. But at the same time, these guys, they're saying and doing things that I understand. And I'm connecting with them.
Yeah, that's, I remember so long ago when I first read something Greek, or, yeah, I think it might have been The Apology or something. Mm-hmm. And I read that, and I remember thinking, these people have the same problems that we've got. And at first being very bummed out by that, because I thought that we should be doing better.
Oh.
You know,
we'd all like
but
that.
But then it's exactly like you're saying there, you know, that was a connection, and you're like, oh, I understand. It's amazing that I can understand what, you know, he was saying.
Yeah. It's like
so many years
time late. Machine.
Yeah.
For just that flash of a second, you're back there with that person in whatever it was, you know,
yeah.
BC.
Touching that mind.
Yeah.
I like that metaphor. It's
yeah.
Great.
Well, and I actually was looking at to see if Owen Barfield, one of the Inklings, had written anything that's still published, and it turns out he has. And the thing for the Kindle I was looking at was called The History of the English Through Language. And the introduction is by W.H. Auden, if that's how you say it, the poet.
Yeah.
And he talks about the fact that what speech does is two things. One is you can pass on technical information, and the second is you're opening yourself up and sharing your experiences. And I'd never thought about it that way. And then thinking about story and thinking about that, that's exactly what's happening in this book. It's
yeah.
It's a beautiful testament to it.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yep.
We must be off track. I don't know where we started.
No. I just love that. Well, you had him on trial for reading. So, Spofforth, suddenly, you know, he let him be with Mary Lou for a while, right?
Yeah.
And then suddenly said, all right, that's enough. You are going to jail.
Yeah.
For reading. So he basically throws him in prison and takes Mary Lou to himself. He moves her into his place,
mm-hmm.
and you know, falls in love with her. And she now we should mention, you said that everybody was taking drugs. Well, one of the things
right.
that the drugs have in them is a well, it makes people fertile, right? I forgot how
no,
it was.
It's a contraceptive.
It's a contraceptive. Okay.
Yeah.
I just couldn't remember how they put it in this.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, so...
But she's allergic to all the drugs.
Yeah, she's allergic to all the drugs, but she's been drug-free for a long time, so,
right.
you know, the contraception is
right.
long gone. So
and
she
Paul's
is pregnant.
Not taking his drugs regularly.
Right,
so.
Exactly. So she is pregnant from Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then off he goes to jail, and that was an interesting experience, but then... you know, and there are things that are laugh out loud funny that happen. It's almost like
yes.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy funny.
Yes.
Or Stanislaw Lem. Well, after he breaks out of jail, the thing that struck me, it just made me laugh out loud, is he's cruising along up the coast, dying for water. He sees a building with lights on, and he goes in there, and there are these robots making toast.
Right.
And they're making toasters and toasters. And he remembers thinking when he was a kid, where are the toasters? Because he had to toast bread on a stick over a fire or something
like
that.
Yeah, their toaster broke and there were no more toasters.
Yeah, exactly. There were no more toasters in the world. So here he stumbled upon a operational toaster factory.
Yeah.
And through some observation, he realized at the end of the line, there is this robot that takes a finished toaster, plugs it into the wall to see if it works. And if it doesn't work, it goes into this bin. And every single toaster that came off this line did not work.
Yeah.
And they went into the bin. And then eventually he'd say, recycle time! And they would take this bin full of toasters, go to the front of the building, and dump them all in this big vat or whatever where they would be recycled so that they could make new toasters.
Yeah.
And so he got his water and everything. And then before he left... You know, after he warmed himself up and everything, before he left, he went to a station where this robot was supposed to put chips into the toaster, a computer chip. And the chip dispenser had a chip that was Skittywampus in it for who knows how many hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And he went over there and he rattled it so that it came down.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, they were making toasters.
Yeah.
And the first one that had the chip in it, the thing plugged in, it worked. And you'd think that this would be something, you know, momentous. But they're robots, and they don't really care. But he went ahead and he put it in the good pile.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the only one in the good pile. And then he left.
Yeah. That's...
That made me laugh and laugh.
That was really... I know. That was that thing of... Well, and the thing I liked, there were little funny things scattered around,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of times they're reported so seriously because what makes them funny is that they don't know they're funny. And one of my favorite silent movie people is Buster Keaton. And early on, he's working on a film and Mary Lou watches it with him. He says, it was called The Stockbroker and its star was Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton is a very intense man who has many unusual difficulties in his films. They would be funny if they were not so sad.
Oh, yeah. That made me laugh out loud, too. I can just see him, no expression on his face, you know, bouncing up and down on that train.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know, the Buster Keaton is so amazing, you know.
I love it so much.
I remember there was a thing where he would stand in a certain spot and this whole front of a house would fall down.
Yes.
And he'd be standing in the window.
Yes.
When it fell all around him. And those were like real stunts that he did. I just can't believe it.
I know. I remember finding out about that just a few years ago. And I guess I'm as bad as Paul. It had never occurred to me to think about it. And I went, oh, my gosh, those were their stars doing that stuff.
Oh, geez,
there were no stuntmen.
Yeah.
But
I never tire of Buster Keaton.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, so but that good. Was a funny, funny line.
So good. Well, and the thing that's kind of interesting, thinking about it just big picture for a second, you've got Mary Lou. She's pregnant. So she's the mother of the human race because this is the first baby that's going to be born in who knows, like 30 years. And then you've got Paul, and when he leaves the prison, there's a man in the prison. This is where he learns how to make friends. And he also becomes a leader of sorts because he's got to get back to Mary Lou, so he figures out a way to escape. Mm-hmm. And they all help him. But he takes a cat with him.
Yeah.
And they had never named the cats. He names the cat. Because he knows animals should have names.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, it just occurred to me while we're talking, I'm thinking, oh, there's more of the Adam and Eve analogy, that they're going to be the regeneration of the how humans should be.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting, too, that Spoforth says to Mary Lou, who was thinking about Paul, that he's going to escape. You know, he's going to, you know, if he wants to, he will escape.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting, because I really thought that... You know, the robot wouldn't want him around. But I thought it's just really interesting that he's like, oh, he's going to escape and he's going to come back.
Well,
and he's going to find you. And, you know, we're going to, you know.
I don't think I remember him saying it that definitely.
He didn't say it that definitely.
Okay.
But what he said definitely is that he's going to escape.
I don't. Okay.
Yeah. I could see if I can find that. But he actually said that. Okay.
I want verification, but we...
Okay.
But what I remember is that he either said to Paul or thought this could be the making of him. It could be really good for him. He doesn't really care. But it's kind of like a passing thought of, well, it could be really good for him. And it is really good for him. Because he becomes physically strong. He learns how to get through adversity. He discovers he knew he loved Mary Lou, but he discovers how much because he decides he's going to go after her. And on the way, in the true road journey story fashion, he encounters a group of people who are all based on religious fundamentalism and living in a mall.
Yes.
That Sears was their church. I'm like, oh, are we saying something about consumerism? I'm not sure. Give me another signal. Because of the few books he could find at the prison where he said, if I don't have something to read, I'm going to go insane. And we all know that feeling, right? One of them is the New Testament. And so he's read the New Testament and he knows just enough that when he encounters these hardcore religious people who are going to kill him for profaning sacred ground, he says a few things and they stop and go, wait, what? And then he asks to be baptized. And they're, okay, you're one of us. And then when he says he can read, they're like, oh my gosh, no one's been able to read the Bible to us forever. Read the Bible.
Right. And I loved that the copy that they had was the Reader's Digest condensed version.
Yeah.
That was
just
great.
Just what you'd find in a 1980s mall store.
Oh, yeah, right.
Probably had a Walden Books right there.
Yeah. Walden Books. Oh, I miss Walden Books.
I kind of do, too.
Yeah.
I miss bookstores in general.
old
days.
The old days, right. Right.
But what he learns...
But yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say what he learns there are, you know, he starts thinking about religion a little more just because he's with all these very religious people and he's reading the Bible. And it's not that he's thinking about it deeply, but it's kind of seeping in, kind of in the way that when you read something and you don't think about it till later, you realize you've kind of incorporated it a little bit in your life.
Yeah.
And he meets somebody who teaches him how to cook. And he says she's kind of like a mother to him in a way, the mother he never had.
Yeah, what did you make of that? I mean, that was something else.
I asked first.
You did ask first. I was like, wait a minute. No, you tell me what to think about it because
Annabelle.
Yeah, so he talks to this lady, you know, he wants to cook just really to be around her. And he tells her, you know, hey, what if we started a family? And she told him no, but what was the reason again?
Well, her husband had died and she wasn't a virgin. And
In
that very strict community, you had to be a virgin or you couldn't get married.
So it was a religious reason that she told him no.
Well, you kind of felt like that was the excuse. She was very melancholy and had thought about immolating herself.
Right. And then she did immolate herself.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, it was heartbreaking.
It was.
And it was heartbreaking for Paul, who probably felt responsible. Although he you don't delve into his feelings right then. But then that's the thing that kicks him and he moves on and goes to Mary Lou.
Yeah, and it's interesting, though. She was the only creator-type person there. She cooked because she enjoyed it, not because it had to happen. She made pots. She, you know, she took care of the housekeping as a gift to the others that was never appreciated, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And that's one of the other things that you see as a subtext thing in here is that human beings create things. It may not be something great, but it's like when Paul says, I have created this journal. I wrote
interesting.
This.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Very interesting. And it seems that the alert people create.
Mm-hmm.
The drugged people do not. Yeah.
Right. Well, because even the people in the prison, they're taking their drugs, but they don't have to take them. And so they've made themselves backpacks and they've, you know, gotten clever about how they use their supplies and things. They, you know, smuggled
that was
in
that was pretty cool. We brought your cat.
Yes, and I love
don't cats. Forget your cat. You forgot your cat. Oh my gosh!
I know. Well, and when he goes to New York, when he gets, he has to figure out how to adapt a thought bus. And I'm like, after, I would like a thought bus, please. Can I have a thought bus?
And that thought bus, it did remind me of Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah.
You know, once he got the thought bus going and he was doing his thing, and then the thought bus talked back to him in his head.
Yeah.
That made me laugh out loud, too, because
for him.
Yeah. And it was so happy. The bus was just so happy.
It had a kindness. It was programmed for kindness. Was that it?
Exactly. Yeah. It was part of the operating system.
Yeah.
Yeah. We talk kindly to you because that's the mode I'm in. I like it.
Why are you so helpful? Oh, we're programmed to be kind to everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Because they could read where you wanted to go in your head, and if they were programmed to know where it was, then... Now, I wanted to ask you something. A key phrase that pops up early in here is where the book's name comes from.
Mm.
And... he says, it is only the mockingbird sings at the edge of the woods. And everybody who hears it, well, of course, that's just him and Mary Lou. And I guess Bob Spofforth, we find out his name is Bob. They react to it, but nobody exactly can put into words what it means.
Yeah. And I think it was a, yeah, it's like a, they're reacting to the poetry of it. Too, but yeah, only a mockingbird. Yeah, I've thought a lot about what it means. I mean, have you thought about what it means? Because
yes, I'm stumped. I'll have to.
It's like, you know, yeah, a mockingbird sings on the edge of the woods, right?
Only the mockingbird sings at the edge of the woods.
So is he at the edge of the woods singing out, or is he at the edge of the woods singing in?
Hmm. See, that's already further than I could get. I just was
yeah,
like,
it's like what? That's the question, I think.
But now that I'm thinking about just the title Mockingbird, without, I always associated it with that sentence, but when I think about it without that, think of how many mockingbirds there are that are just imitating life, human life in this book. There are the people who are drugged. There is, you know, Bob. There are, you know, even the religious community. There are all these people who are not human, even though they are human. They're like mockingbirds. They're imitating humanity. They're imitating life like that.
Right. So a mockingbird imitates the sounds of other birds, right?
Yes. Always three times in a row, and then it changes them. We live near Mockingbird Lane, by the way.
Okay.
State Bird of Texas. We have a zillion of them.
Awesome.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. They are great birds, and I'll tell everybody all about them sometime if they care.
So, mockingbird. But it's not mockingbirds. So mm-mm. Mockingbird is not, it's probably talking about Paul, right?
Well,
so it's
not Spofforth?
You know, if Paul is the main character...
But maybe it's Spofforth because look how he affects everybody because he's not allowed to be fully human.
Yeah, but I don't know. Is he mimicking other people? It's almost like, you know, everybody in the world is mimicking each other, mm-hmm. but they're not really living.
Mm-hmm. Mary Lou isn't because she was taken under the wing of an old renegade type guy when she got out of the system. And he was old enough that he could remember his grandfather's stories and things, which linked to our time more. I mean, not directly, obviously, but it, and things were recognizable to us, you know, like when people would read books. And Paul begins as being a normal person, except he's got just enough curiosity to puzzle out how to read. And that makes him suddenly start on this path that leaves him fully human and different also.
Hmm.
I don't think we can answer this easily, but
I don't think we can either.
It's I just was curious. I
just looked up the word mockingbird
mm-hmm.
and in my Kindle version here, and it came up 14 times, and almost, well, Every single time but one is the phrase, "Only the mockingbird sings at the edge of the woods."
What's
and
the other
one? And the only other one is, "Of course I do not know what a mockingbird is." At the beginning.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's even more mysterious to them.
Right.
Well, and one of the most touching things is at the end when Spofforth can finally die because Mary Lou will and Paul will kill him.
Right.
And,
but it's super important what, you know, that was a revelation to me that Spofforth is the reason why no one's having any children.
I know.
That was huge. And the reason that he was doing it. Yeah, and the reason that he was doing it is because he can be released when there are no more people to care for.
Right.
And that is where I started thinking Asimov. Now, I'm not sure if Asimov wrote that stuff after or before 1980.
Hmm.
I would have to look at that. Well, no, I mean, robots as caretakers.
Oh,
And then, you know, when you take the laws of robotics to a bigger extreme, when you're looking at humanity as a whole, it's like you can justify all kinds of things.
Oh, well,
just the way people do in government, you know, it's like, we'll do all these other things, you know, because it's for the good, the common good of the people.
Yeah.
Right. So that kind of thing.
Many a Star Trek episode turned on that too.
Yes. Yes. Like
the robot who was doing things completely wrong. Well, and right. iRobot, when we watched it, which expanded on that, the movie.
Right. Yeah, and then we have Spofforth or Spofforth. Mm-hmm. I still don't know how to say his name.
Yeah.
But that was astounding. So he was willing to eradicate humanity, to get rid of them just so that he could be done.
But the reason he said he was willing to do it, I mean, I think this was a kind of a bit of a lie. As Mary Lou says at one point, can robots lie? And he doesn't say anything. And you're just like, what's been going on? Hold on. But when she's mad at him, she's like, you're going to kill the human race. And he says, well, it's the only way I can get any peace. And she says, well, but wait. And he says, you guys aren't happy.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing? You're very unhappy. So it's okay. She's like, well, I'm not. And you find out, of course, later she got him to quit giving. All the drug machines are going to break down, and there's no contraceptives for anyone. So welcome back to the world, everybody.
And that really surprised the hell out of me, because I thought he wanted a baby, which is why I thought this whole thing happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he tells her that, well, I want you to go ahead and have an abortion. All the make sevens know how to do one. And he was, it was just like, what?
That was a terrible moment.
It was. It really blew me away.
Yeah.
And then the way she got out of that is she said, well, I could kill you. I promise to do it if you help me have this baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she's like, okay.
Yeah. It's all right. I'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Paul returns, and he is a changed man.
Mm-hmm.
She says something like, you look like you could do anything. Something like that. I can't remember her exact words, but
he's very self-confident by that point.
He's like, dun-da!
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and there are two things at the end. One is when he's on his way, Paul is on his way to New York City, and he's looking at the ocean, which he loves so much. And he's talking about how he read in a history book. And his interpretations of what the history book says and his own conclusions are quite interesting, I think. At one point he goes, it says Jesus is a great man, but I think from the history books, great men are not really desirable.
Mm.
But at the same time, Paul is turning himself into a great man for that world. So...
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. But he says, you know, at one time people might have worshipped oceans. And he goes, that seems kind of right. And he says, even though that religious society wouldn't have liked it. And then he says, I think I may already be a worshiper of the ocean. In reading the New Testament aloud to the Balenes, I developed a strong admiration for Jesus as a sad and terribly knowing prophet, a man who had grasped something about life of the greatest importance and had attempted and largely failed to tell what it was. I can feel in myself a kind of love for him and in his and for his attempt in saying things like, "The kingdom of heaven is within you," for I think I glimpse his meaning here, looking out of the thought bus window toward the still and gray expanse of the Atlantic Ocean with the sun about to rise on it. Yet I cannot myself say what the meaning is, but I trust it far more than the nonsense I was taught as a child in the dormitory. And later he says something, and now let's see if I can find it. He says, "I am the way and the truth and the life," and he's quoting, "He that believeth in me, though he die, yet he shall live. My life is light waiting for the death wind, like a feather on the back of my hand. And without the ability to read, I would never..." that's the wrong thing. Because at one point what he does is he says that thing about, "I'm the way and the truth and the life," and he says, "I think I could actually just follow anybody who said something like that because it's such a wonderful truth. I want it." And now I can't find it, of course, but I got sidetracked.
Yeah, let's see.
You may have to edit
it. It says, I've actually highlighted the same thing.
Okay, good.
Let me back up just a touch, and he says, "Yeah, the back part of the Holy Bible is about Jesus Christ. Some sentences in it have been underlined by a former reader." Then he starts, he says a couple of the sayings of Jesus. He says, one that is very strong is, "I am the way and the truth and the life." Mm-hmm. And another, "Come unto me, all ye who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." If someone should come to me and say, "I am the way and the truth and the life," I would want with all my strength to believe him. I want those things, a way, the truth, and life. As well as I understand it, Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, the one who was supposed to have made heaven and earth. That perplexes me and makes me feel that Jesus was unreliable. Still, he seems to have known things that others did not know and was not a silly person, like those in Gone with the Wind, or a murderously ambitious one like the American presidents. Whatever Jesus was, he was a thing called a great man. I am not certain I like the idea of great men. It makes me uncomfortable. Great men often have very bloody plans for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then Spofforth definitely did.
Yeah. Well, but I was thinking of the when he said, I would like that, a way, the truth, and the life. And it's like, that's what we all want. That's the basic thing we all are looking for.
Yeah.
With all these stories that we tell each other and read and the stories of our lives, essentially.
Right. Near the end, I highlighted something about reading. Should I read that?
Please.
Okay. The section starts off, he says, "My God, the things I have read and learned since I left Ohio, and they have changed me so much I hardly recognize myself. Just knowing that there has been a past to human life and getting a slight sense of what past was like have altered my mind and my behavior beyond recognition." And then I'm skipping a paragraph. And then he says, "But most of all, it seems to me now, has been the courage to know and to sense my feelings that has come slowly from the emotionally charged silent films at the old library at first, and then later from poems and novels and histories and biographies and How to Do It books that I have read. All those books, even the dull and nearly incomprehensible ones, have made me understand more clearly what it means to be a human being. And I have learned from the sense of awe I at times develop when I feel in touch with the mind of another long dead person. And I know that I am not alone on this earth. There have been others who have felt as I feel and who have, at times, been able to say the unsayable. Only the mockingbird sings at the edge of the woods. I am the way and the truth and the life. He that believeth in me, though he die, yet shall he live. My life is light, waiting for the death wind, like a feather on the back of my hand. And without the ability to read, I never would have found a way to get this thought bus moving, taking me to New York and to Mary Lou, whom I must try to see again before I die." Yeah, nice so passage. Good. It is. Way to go, Walter.
Yeah. Well, he's an interesting writer because he wrote The Man Who Fell to Earth. He wrote The Color of Money, and what was the, or I think, and what was the one that came before it, The Hustler?
Oh, I didn't know that. He wrote those?
Yeah. And he wrote a book called, I can't remember. I'm thinking Gambit, but I don't think that's the right name. But it is about a young girl who's a chess genius, and I think he was really into chess from the one library room that's full of chess books. And my mom read that, and she said she felt after reading that book the way I did after reading this one, she couldn't read another book for 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
Because it struck her so deeply. That's it, The Queen.
The Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. No, okay.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, I must read it then.
So he wrote such varied things, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's neat. Yeah, and Mockingbird is one of the SF Masterworks series.
Is it?
Of books from the Golansk? Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, 2007 they published it. So, yeah, amazing.
Okay.
I had no idea. I honestly had never heard of it till you said, we're reading this. Okay.
Oh, well, that's, you know. Yeah, all right, fine.
And it was marvelous.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. Yeah, and the second time through was really pretty amazing. I was going to read it slowly and thoughtfully, and I couldn't. I just kept reading faster and faster.
Just bam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad. Yeah, I don't have anything else.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and I'm going to definitely read that Queen's Gambit, too. It just surprised me, The Color of Money as well. That's neat.
Yeah, I know. Really different topics, but, of course, probably delving into the same kinds of ideas in terms of how, you know, the stories of our lives and how do we become who we are.
I think that the question that everybody is probably wanting the answer to is, would Carl Urban play Spoforth or would he play Paul?
Wow, Well, you know, Spoforth was the only black robot.
Uh-huh, that's true.
So if you're going to cast true, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a mighty fine-looking black robot I watched who was with Carl Urban in, what is it called, Almost Human?
Almost, yeah, that's
the
right.
The show that Fox unfairly canceled.
They keep doing that.
Yes, they do. And
it's
that
not
man
right.
Make a wonderful Spofforth, I just want to say, with his gorgeous gray-blue eyes and his... his blackness that was very important to Spofforth. Although they, you know, it was funny because when they talk about, you know, creating him, they're like, he was beautiful. You know, he had his thick lips and his brown skin and his all this, and he was just beautiful. But he was the only black one they ever created. And later Mary Lou says, well, were there any other black ones? And no, why not? I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, cool. All right. Well, what have we got coming up now?
Documentary?
Yeah, that is right. Yeah, documentary, Life Itself, about Roger Ebert.
Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Yeah, good. I hope you enjoy it.
I bet I will.
Yep, I liked it. And then we're going to read The Caine Mutiny by Herman Wouk.
That is waiting for me at the library. I'm going to pick it up tomorrow. Cool.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Ooh, and then I love the one after that.
Huh? What?
What is it? A movie called The Dirty Dozen.
Oh, The Dirty Dozen. Yeah. Right. That's right. I'm not looking at anything. I'm just...
Oh, okay.
I'm going to
that. Oh, that's going to be cool. That'll be fun. So a couple weeks in World War II. And then after that, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which does not take place in World War II, as most people think.
No. It does have quite the ensemble cast, though.
Cool.
Cast of many, many people. Yes.
I love it. I'm eager to read that. That'll be fun.
Have you read it before?
No, I have not.
Okay. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
It's Dickens and she, Harriet Beecher Stowe, very much admired each other's work.
Oh, cool.
And she's no Dickens, but you can really feel, I mean, you know, it was her first book, so I'm going to give her a huge break on it. But it was much better than Dickens' first books, and it was, it's, you can see that same style, that cliffhanger style going through it, so.
Nice. All right. Well, great. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Yes.
And that's it for episode number 110.
Okay. Well, have a great couple of weeks, and we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. You bet. See you later, all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.